And the award goes to Millennial at the Movies. Welcome to Millennial at the Movies, a podcast review of the good, the bad, and the ugly Oscar-winning movies. Grab a bucket of popcorn and enjoy.
Last time on Millennial at the Movies, we were introduced to the first sound film to win Best Picture, The Broadway Melody. In case you missed my review on it, it's a bad movie. End of story. I still suggest listening to my second episode because you will get to hear my full rant about how this is such an incompetent film, especially for today. But we're talking about a very fantastic film today. I'm happy to say that I will be talking about 1930s All Quiet on the Western Front. All Quiet on the Western Front is a war film released by Universal Studios in 1930. The film was the first Best Picture to be adapted from a novel, based on the story of the same name by Erich Maria Remarque. It's directed by Louis Milestone and stars Lou Ayres and Louis Wilhelm. How well does this picture talk about the depressing effects of German soldiers in World War I? Let's find out! The film opens with a patriotic musical score, followed by an epigraph that reads, "The story is neither an accusation nor a confession, and least of all an adventure. For death is not an adventure to those who stand face to face with it. It'll try simply to tell of a generation of men who, even though they may escape its shells, were destroyed by the war." We already know based on that first scene that this isn't going to be a glorifying take on the war, but rather a realist sort of film. I never felt watching this movie that I was forced to feel a certain way about what I was watching. It felt like the director was just telling a story of what happens to young men before, during, and after the war. The one glaring thing to take notice is that every German young man has an American accent because German people have American accents. That's so realistic and convincing. Way to go, Hollywood. It's Hollywood's fault anyway for not casting German actors for the leading roles, but white American men. The professor, on the other hand, the villain, I guess, there's no clear villain because not only does everybody lose, the war itself is the villain, but anyway, the professor has a slight German accent and yells at the men to go fight for the fatherland. One of the quotes he says is, "Give every ounce of strength to victory before the end of the year." The Germans believe that their involvement in the war would be quick and sort of painless for them. Someone's in for a rude awakening. While the creepy beady-eyed teacher finishes his speech, the boys, led by Paul, played by Ayres, goes out and cheers about going to the war. I legitimately giggled when the boys were all like, "No more classes!" Because as I'm typing this and recording this episode, it's finals week, and I 100% relate to not wanting to go to class ever again, drop my responsibilities, and, well, okay, I wouldn't want to go to war, but it's an exaggeration. Finals week is killing me. Anyway, the boys cheerfully march and sing a German patriotic song. There's a cool still shot of the boys throwing papers and leaving the classroom one by one as they sing about fighting for their country. I mean, there's a decent amount of still shots that hold on the scene, and usually I'm not one for still shots, but the difference here is that these scenes have a purpose, unlike in Broadway Melody. Anyway, we see the boys leaving, foreshadowing that this will be the last time they'll be in this classroom, but we have a feeling they aren't going to make it out alive, thanks to this still shot. The boys are really excited to go out to combat, but they aren't aware of what they have to go through, basic training. When they meet their general Himmelstoss, the boys recognize him and he's like, "Hey buddy, old pal," but then he establishes himself as the jerk of the group and demands the boys, "Silence, call me sir, and forget everything you knew. You're going to be soldiers, and that's all. If you aren't soldiers, I will kill you." Okay, he doesn't say the last part, but I'm just setting the mood here. He's basically throwing reality into their face. Everybody regrets their life choices at this point and mess with Himmelstoss by getting him drunk and capturing him, probably trying to kill him. Also, apparently why the Germans lost the war is because they were too busy messing around. The boys get to the war front and someone is already killed and there's no food, though they expect food, and now everyone is happy and cheerful. Who knew? Disillusionment, man. We're introduced to Cap, played by Wilhelm, one of the older soldiers that has a talent for hunting down food. The first shot we see of him is him stealing a pig like a clever swine. Ha ha, you guys appreciate my puns? Thanks. No oinking around. Ha ha ha. Okay, I'm talking about a serious war film here. Then Kat starts to sound like an Italian gangster rather than a German soldier, but screw it, accents are a joke in this movie anyway. The boys begin to respect Kat because he brought them food. Also how people earn my respect. Bring me Chipotle, we're fine. Because this movie doesn't give that much time to breathe, the boys move to the trenches and see some PTSD heading their way. One of the boys, Franz, gets blinded and goes crazy as he runs into machine gun fire. He's left to die while the rest of the boys make it to the trenches. Paul runs back for Franz to try to save him because he's one of his friends, to which Kat stops him and says, "It's a corpse, no matter who it is." Side note, most millennials think of older movies as boring black and white movies with not enough stupid one-liners and action scenes. Don't get me wrong, I love these movies. Well, mostly. But films like this one are part of a Hollywood history called the pre-code era. It was a five-year period where Hollywood studios didn't enforce the motion picture production code, which means all the profanity, violence, sex, anything unholy, semi-provocative, full fair game in these movies. And if it weren't for pre-code, we wouldn't see blood coming out of Franz's eyes. We wouldn't see all these gory war scenes. It's pretty cool. Everyone returns to his bunker as Franz is going manic and hallucinating. At that, there are rats everywhere, and it's not a pleasant scene. Mostly because of the rats. Totally not because a man's going manic and hallucinating. No, totally not. It's the rats, guys. It's up to the boys to take over the enemy trench, and it's time for me to point out the biggest strength of the film. Artistry. It sounds like a pretentious word to me, artistry, but there's some solid cinematography here for 1930, and it still holds up today. It's great. There's a scene where the enemy soldier grabs onto barbed wire like a moron, gets hit by a grenade, and then all that's left after he explodes are his hands on the barbed wire. No wrists, nothing. Like, his hands are disembodied from his body. You can see the bone and the flesh and the horror of war. A technical aspect to note that I imagine some people would be bothered by if they saw this film, but the sound of the bombs and the gunfire during the war scenes are distorted. They don't sound crisp at all. Granted, I'm no expert on military warfare, and that could easily be what the sound of battlefields are, but I somehow doubt that. If this aspect takes away from the impact of what's happening in these scenes, I don't blame you. To me, it's just a slight error on what's a fantastic film all around. We see more strong imagery as the soldiers are shooting around their dead comrades, followed by the soldiers that survive walking to the local town with food awaiting for them, because they've been starving for several days and they need food, damn it. The chef, passing out the food, he's kind of a dick. I know that's not a nice word to say, but he's a dick. He complains to Kat about he cooked meals for 150 soldiers and only 80 of them came back. He's kind of refusing to realize the fact that half of them died out in the field. And the ones that survived already were traumatized by what they saw. Just give them food. It's the least you can do. Satisfy their basic needs. Come on. Kat insists on giving the soldiers two servings for they were starving for several days. But the chef is all like, "Wah, I took too much food. One serving only. That's the rule." Although he never fought in combat, he's just the chef. So Kat insists that no, he does not understand what fighting in the war is like. Please just give him food. They've been starving for several days. Well, the chef's higher command comes by and asks why the heck the soldiers haven't been served yet. Get your head out of your butt and help them to the food. Well, after that conflict is over, again, saved by food, always a good way to go. Paul, Kat, and some of the other soldiers talk about why are they in the war in the first place? Who decided that innocent civilians would fight in the war instead of the politicians? It was the Kaiser, Kaiser Wilhelm, that started this war in the first place. Why have other people battle for him? To which probably the funniest line of dialogue in the film comes from Kat as he responds with, and I'm paraphrasing here, "Instead of having a war, why don't we have the leaders of Europe be stripped to their underwear and fight it out with clubs?" Good question. My lessons in World War I history back in high school would be very different if that happened. Paul and his comrades decide to walk a couple miles to visit Franz, the soldier that went blind and catatonic. What they realize, but Franz doesn't necessarily realize because he's been in a depressive state, he is much worse off than he thinks he is. His leg is amputated, which he believes is just foot pain. And then once he realizes his leg is amputated, he loses all hope. Well, because there's so many soldiers, very few doctors, and a massive lack of medical advancement compared to what he's used to, I suppose. Or just a product of the times, there wasn't much medical advancement anyway. Franz is dead at age 19. Yes, there are soldiers fighting at age 18 and 19 and dying. It's sad, but there's no time to rest once another battle scene follows, because this film does not allow you to rest at all. The next scene, Captain I Take Everything Too Seriously and I Don't Know What I'm Doing Hittlesauce is killed. Paul kills a French soldier and feels awful about it. We see a scene where Paul tries to ask the soldier for forgiveness, realizing the toll of his actions and the toll the war is taking on him. There's a lot of crying and whining in this scene, because in the end, he's just a young boy. Of course, everything's fine after Paul and his friends go after some French girls on their day off and sleep with them. But is he fine? No, he's not. Any ounce of confidence Paul's feel is shot down. I swear that was not an intended pun. As he's wounded on the battlefield in the next scene and has to go to a Catholic hospital, which in the movie is depicted as kind of the end-all be-all of hospitals. Basically, if you're sent to a Catholic hospital, it means you're gonna die eventually. Well, he's told that he's not going to survive, but in fact, he does, and he's triumphant about it. He gets to go home for about a month or so, and when he returns to his hometown, he's shocked to see how no one seems to get the horrors of war. The disillusionment really sets in here. And the theme of duality between home life and war life is most prevalent in the scene when he visits home. The sister and mother still see Paul as a young boy that needs to be taken care of, which his innocence is completely gone, so he's no longer that young boy. The first school teacher teaching Paul about the glory of fighting for Germany is still there, now telling the same speech to an even younger group of boys. Paul sees this and is shocked, as the teacher asks him to tell the boys about what it's like to fight. In case you haven't noticed, it's harrowing and awful. I can't do the speech justice, so here's a clip from the film where Paul addresses the class.
I can't tell you anything you don't know. We live in the trenches out there. We fight. We try not to be killed. Sometimes we are. That's all.
No. No, Paul. I've been there. I know what it's like. That's not what one dwells on, Paul.
I heard you in here reciting that same old stuff, making more iron men, more young heroes. You still think it's beautiful and sweet to die for your country, don't you? We used to think you knew. The first bombardment taught us better. It's dirty and painful to die for your country. When it comes to dying for your country, it's better not to die at all. There are millions out there dying for their countries. What good is it?
It's an impactful scene that makes the film hold up as well as it did back in 1930. The horrors of war haven't changed, the morality of Paul's actions hasn't changed, and World War I, the war to end all wars, was the first of many where innocent men lost their lives over the glory of fighting for their country. Soapbox time, here we go. I respect soldiers here in the United States that go overseas to fight for freedom. I come from a military family. I have cousins and uncles and family members that choose to enlist and go overseas. Some of them fought in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's an ultimate sacrifice that they are doing, especially since there's no draft. You choose to enlist, but I don't believe in praising war and pretending these men and women are going to be okay after they kill some people, as the politicians ask them to. It's really not our war, it's a politician's war over, well, granted, it's over some either religion or some tangible object like oil in the Middle East, but it's still very shocking to me. And I can honestly say I don't comprehend what war actually entails, and I don't understand the meaning of it and why we have to have it. I know it sounds really hippy dippy, but I just don't get it. It's so shocking to me that there are young men like Paul that still exist today, and there's so much ignorance about the severe effects of combat, like the school teacher today. You would think, after going to several wars, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, war in Iraq, etc., you would think, but enough of my soapbox, let's finish up this review. Paul returns early to the second company to see not many familiar faces, but instead a lot of 16-year-olds that have enlisted that he just saw in the classroom. He sees Kat, though, which is a great thing because Kat was awesome in the film. They reunite and discuss pretty much the rant I just went on. How do people not get how awful this war is? A bomb drops, and Kat is seriously injured. Paul tries to save him by carrying him to a nearby hospital, but he ends up dying, leaving Paul crushed by the loss of his mentor. Then there's the final scene, one of the best closing scenes of all time. We start off with sad harmonica music as Paul returns to the front lines to fight. He sees a butterfly, a metaphor for something beautiful and tragedy. He reaches out for it and is shot and killed for being exposed. There's a creepy as hell final shot. There's a dead silent flashback of all the soldiers, presumably all the ones from the beginning. They're marching on their first day, shadowed by crosses that symbolize how many lives were lost. They're literally marching to their death. That's pretty much what the film is saying. It's very somber to watch, and it's the perfect note to end the movie on. No ending music, just silence as it should be. And that was All Quiet on the Western Front, a film that deserves to be seen by audiences my age. As far as adaptations go, it holds up to the novel pretty well. Yep, I read the book. The ending is different, and I won't spoil the novel's ending for you, but Lewis Milestone was inspired by a shot of Paul's butterfly collection in the scene where he first comes home and decided to add that to the film and make that the ending in the film. The actors already finished shooting, so Lewis Milestone had to shoot the scene himself, so it's Milestone's hand that appears in the final shot, not Ares. To keep with some authenticity, though, other than the German soldiers with their American accents, still doesn't make sense to me. To keep with some authenticity, 2,000 extras that were former German soldiers living in Los Angeles appeared in the film. Fun fact, one of them would be future director Fred Zinnemann, who would go on to direct classic films such as High Noon and From Here to Eternity, which is a movie I'm going to be covering later in this series. The film would go on to win Academy Awards for Best Picture and Milestone won for Best Director. It's also considered the 54th best film on 1998 American Film Institute's 100 Years, 100 Films list. As for me, this is the best film that I've covered in the series so far, and I give it a 9 out of 10. It's a beautiful realism film that, although isn't remembered much for its dialogue and sometimes the acting is a little outdated, no, seriously, the American accents on German soldiers really bothers me. But nonetheless, the message is impactful, the cinematography is terrific, and the story continues to be relevant today. Next episode, I discuss a film entirely outdated and a product of its times, a Western from 1931, Cimarron.
That concludes tonight's episode of Millennial at the Movies. Catch us next time at the movies, because remember,
there's no place like home.